You're listening to Veeam Partner Perspectives with Eric Dougherty. Welcome to the Veeam Partner Perspectives podcast. I'm Eric Dougherty. My guest today is Ned Belavance, a tech educator and content creator, and you may know him as Ned in the Cloud. Ned, I've known you for a few years before you went out on your own and was lucky enough to run into you again recently at a conference where you gave a great keynote. Welcome to the podcast. Can you share a little bit about your background and what Ned in the Cloud is all about?
Yeah, absolutely. And thank you, Eric, for having me on the podcast. I appreciate it. Yeah, so Ned in the Cloud is a company I started about 5 years ago that is focused entirely on creating educational content for technical people. And that takes a bunch of different formats, whether it's Pluralsight courses, podcasts, videos, blogs. But the main theme through all of it is I want to educate and, if possible, entertain people a little bit around cloud technologies, infrastructure as code, and DevOps principles.
Great. Yeah, it's awesome. And I see your content out there all the time. And I always love it because it is exactly what you described. And I also get to go, I know that guy, you know, so it's kind of funny. Like, you know, when I ran into you for the keynote, everybody's like, wow. And I'm like, I know him already. That's so awesome. So I was so glad to run into you. And that keynote that I mentioned was about AI. I found it absolutely fascinating because it was a topic I was getting myself into and starting to read a little bit more anyway, beyond what the commercials on TV are defining AI as, or what marketing defines AI as. And one of the reasons I loved what you did is because it took the complexities of AI and put it into a language that everyone understands. I was hoping we'd cover some of those topics today. So first one, take the broadest one first, is how do you define AI? Because it seems like a really general term and marketing's taken it over so that it's a broad term like defining cloud. So how do you define AI?
Oh, geez. I think it's a bit of a moving target, right?
Mm-hmm.
Things that we would have considered AI 10 years ago are just features that are now part of whatever we're doing. So like predictive texting, when you're texting somebody now, those suggestions that come up, those are AI, but we don't think about them that way. That's just predictive texting. And in the same way that Dragon Naturally Speaking was basically magic 20 years ago, like being able to speak into a computer and it tells me the words that I'm using, this is amazing. I remember when I was a kid, my dad was a practicing lawyer and he had a secretary and a dictaphone, and he would literally speak into this dictaphone and then pull out these tiny little mini cassettes and give it to her. And she would sit there and transcribe everything that he dictated. This was like pre-adopting Microsoft Word and everything.
Yeah.
And essentially that whole transaction was turned into something that was fully automated by Dragon Naturally Speaking and products like it. And it was amazing at the time, but now that's just banal, right?
It's expected.
Right. So I think AI to me is anything that has not reached banality yet. It's still exciting. It's still interesting. And it still involves computers building things like neural networks to reason in a way that if it's not like a human, it's beyond just simple calculation. I mean, sure, when you boil it all down, it's still simple calculations, right? It's vector math.
Zeros and ones. It's never going to be anything more than that.
Absolutely. But I mean, if you boil the human brain, well, don't boil a human brain, please. But if you go down to what's happening inside a human brain, it's electricity and firing synapses, right? So we can get down to that fundamental construct for both. But if you expand your view out a little bit, I think of AI as anything that is still doing really interesting work and involves some level of reasoning or some level of what we would describe as intelligence on the computer's side. And yeah, like I said, that's a moving target.
Yeah, I get exactly what you're saying, because I was thinking, I always joke that the original AI was Clippy in Microsoft Word. Because think about what Copilot and things, tools like that are doing now. They're doing it well. Everybody hated Clippy. I think he got a bad rap, but at the same rate, he was intrusive, was part of his biggest problem.
Yeah.
But he was, you know, kind of like the precursor to Copilot. Now everybody loves Copilot and nobody could stand Clippy. So he got a bad rap, but that's kind of the same thing. It was, they were trying to predict what you were doing based on what you were typing and the type of documents you were opening. You know, kind of like a failure to launch with poor old Clippy, but here we are at the Copilot days and it's the same kind of thing.
Yeah. Funny story about the Clippy thing. I used to work help desk for a small company, and one of my marketing people, we gave her a new computer, and she goes, "Where's the cat?" I'm like, "What cat? What are you talking about?" And I don't know if people might not remember, but Clippy was not the only option.
Yeah. Geez, the default option. Here's the default option, but not the only one. Yeah.
There was, in fact, a cat as another option. And she had grown used to having the cat in her Microsoft Word. Oh. And when we gave her the new one, it wasn't enabled. And she was like totally lost without her cat.
Oh, I was like, goodness. So that was the person that kept Clippy alive for one more version.
Oh, she did. She did. And this is probably like 2003
sure.
era. So yeah, just before Clippy's demise. What's funny, the concept of a conversational AI, an AI that can carry on a conversation with you, actually goes really far back to the 1960s. There was a chatbot written called Eliza that was meant to be a reflective counselor of types. So it would just reflect back anything that you said. Like, why am I so sad? Well, why do you think you're so sad? What is like, it played the role of therapist, but people who used it, I mean, granted they weren't as educated in technology at the time, but people that used it formed a bond with Eliza immediately because they felt that she was helping them, even though it was just a very simple program that was just mirroring back whatever you were saying. So this technology goes back decades. It's just that we've had these step improvements over time that have been caused by some major advancement in another area of technology.
Yeah, I've done some reading as well. And like you said, going back decades, it was really what the first big advancement for it was then the internet, because there was more data available for these engines to learn. And that changed a lot.
Yeah, especially when we're talking about large language models, they need two things. They need a whole bunch of data to use as their basis for the model, and they need a ton of compute power to do that. And we were lacking in both of those for a long time until along came the internet, and you could just kind of scrape it.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I don't want to get into the ethics of that because they're a little dicey, but that's essentially what these companies do. And then the other big step improvement was the formulation of GPUs and the fact that sort of accidentally they were really good at vector math. And that's how we were building these neural networks and models was leveraging that vector math. And so we just saw this explosion of use of GPUs in a way that they were totally never intended for.
Which is another reason that companies like NVIDIA are doing so well right now, because everybody needs them. They're filling everything up trying to run these models right now. And the same goes for the image recognition and sentiment recognition and facial recognition programs. Again, with the internet, you have these image bases. I know that they work off of specific image sets for learning. But once you learn off of those models, then you go. And it's kind of interesting when you read about how those learning sets come together and that the fact you think about it. And this is what I think starts to change things as far as what a human does versus what a computer does. Imagine if a human was only taught what animals were off of 100 pictures.
Right.
As opposed to looking around their environment. A computer still can't look around its environment. We still tell it what its environment is.
That is one of the biggest challenges with these large language models and AI in general is a lack of context. They're artificial intelligence, but they're very narrow in their scope of what they understand. They're not a generalized human. So, we grow up and we learn spatial relationships. You can watch a baby figuring this out in real time. Like they take the spoon and they drop the spoon on the floor and then you give it back to them. And what do? They drop it on the floor again. And they'll do that 10 or 15 times because they're learning when I drop something, it falls down. And that's like babies are little scientists that are just constantly doing these experiments. And like you and I both know, we have kids. It's a little grating to the adults. But for the children, they are literally learning how the world functions and how they function in it. And this is information that AI does not have. Yeah. So if you show it 100 pictures of animals, it has no idea how to interpret those pictures as a human might. It doesn't think about, well, what's on the other side of that elephant? So if you want to teach it what an elephant looks like, you have to show it an elephant from every possible angle because it can't extrapolate that from a single image.
That's true. And that kind of makes me think of when little kids, you know, the game of peekaboo and how they, you know, as soon as they shut your eyes, they think everything's gone. The computer's kind of the same way. It's either present or not present. And like, right. A great example, if there's a rhinoceros standing, in the distance behind the zebra, it can't grasp the concept that there could be other things around. It's only about the zebra. Or even sometimes that, you know, it will see a picture of a zebra, a giraffe, a lion. It can't grasp the concept that a zebra is never going to have that long neck, that, the zebra is never going to have a mane like a lion. It just sees all that. And then it starts to categorize things as animals. And then, you know, you have to start teaching it even more: animals that have long necks, animals that have manes, animals that have stripes. And it's all these different categories, and it's the linking together of those. That's where the challenge comes in, is teaching it the association between all these things.
Yeah. And humans have such a wild capacity to categorize things, but define the category loosely. We're comfortable with that for the most part. Like, there's no such thing as a tree. Let that sink in. Like, there are plants that have grown tall, and so they fit our description of a tree. But from like a pure biological standpoint, there's no such thing as a tree.
Yeah. Well, that's like a weed. I feel the same. There's no such thing as a weed. A weed is anything that's growing where you don't want it to grow.
Exactly. So like, humans are very comfortable with these loosey-goosey categories, and computers are generally not. Yeah. They like hard and fast definitions. So part of what we've built into these large language models and other neural network and machine learning models is the idea of uncertainty, that it's not deterministic, and that allows them to be a little fuzzier with their categories.
Yeah. So it's a percentage of certainty. They base on percentages. I'm, 60% sure that person in that picture is smiling. Right. And they are smiling. I'm 60% sure that they're happy, not that somebody's standing on their foot and they're wincing.
Right, right. Because, yeah, the same, almost the same facial expression can mean two very different things. And that's like nuance, right? Another thing that they're not, AI is not great at
they're
is
They're not good
nuance.
At sarcasm.
No.
I just love that product. Or I just love that product. They don't really, yes, they can start to learn some of the differences in that language, but they're not going to pick up on it. And again, there's some humans that can't pick up on sarcasm either, but most folks know when somebody is being genuine or not. So it's a heck of a lot harder to teach somebody, again, those gray areas, to teach AI those gray areas.
Yeah, I think we can almost think of it like a clash of cultures. For instance, so my sister moved to Texas to teach when she graduated college. And we come from the East Coast. We got a nice vein of rich sarcasm. And that was something that the folks in Houston were not that's not something that they typically used. So there was a lot of early miscommunication with my sister and some of the people she met in Houston because she would use sarcasm and they would interpret it wrong.
Oh boy. Yeah.
And it's not that either side was doing something incorrectly. It was just a mismatch of communication. And so whenever two cultures meet, you have to give great allowances for mismatches in communication. And I won't say that AI is a culture, but it certainly has a way to approach things. And as much as we're trying to teach the tool, we also have to learn how it interacts with us.
That makes sense. So it's kind of like, if we're asking things of it, we have to either make sure we're phrasing the question in a way it will understand. So there's learning on both sides.
Yes.
It's not just the model that's learning. It's us that's learning. How do I ask it a question? It's not going to be able to answer questions like, what are you doing right now?
Right. And I think part of what made ChatGPT such an immediate success was that the learning curve was extremely low. Mm-hmm. To almost non-existent, because the technology had progressed to the point where you didn't have to think as closely about the way that you were phrasing a question.
Yeah.
So if I think about like the way that I get information out of a database, I have to write a SQL query, and that query has to be
accurate. Yeah,
exactly. If I want the right information, I have to be dead on accurate. I have to follow the proper syntax. And let me tell you something, Eric, I am terrible at writing SQL queries. Just abysmal.
Preach into the choir. Yes.
But I could have ChatGPT write a SQL query for me, mm-hmm. and I can just express what I'm looking for in natural language, and it can go pull that database. Is it going to be perfect? No, absolutely not. But it's going to be a heck of a lot closer than if I try to bang out some awful SQL on my own.
That's why I love ChatGPT. You never have to stare at a blank page to get started.
That's right.
I do that with PowerShell scripts too.
Yeah. And even if it's 100% wrong, even if every line has to change, it's something.
Yes.
And sometimes yes. knowing what's wrong helps you figure out what's right.
Yes, exactly. I always say that. I do a lot of education too. And I always say you learn more from when things don't work than when things do work. So that's a great learning opportunity too.
So I do a lot of live instruction about twice a month. Once or twice a month, I deliver live training over Zoom for HashiCorp Academy. And my favorite part of teaching is the questions that I get. Mm. Because I might think that I'm explaining a concept perfectly.
Yeah.
And then I'll get back a series of questions that shows me the ways in which I didn't explain it clearly and the assumptions that my students are making when I say things. And that helps me become a better teacher if mm-hmm. I learn from that feedback. But it also means that I have a better mental model of how something works because they've asked a probing question that I may have taken for granted. And I go, you know, I thought I knew how this worked, but let me check. Let me dig into this. I know we're straying from AI a little bit.
No, but it's still fascinating stuff because it all feeds into how those models work. And that's, let's face it, right now, ChatGPT, Gen AI, Copilot, Gemini, those are the things that Apple Intelligence, I guess, as people start to get that insult, that's what people know of AI today. That's the frame of reference for many people of what AI is. Mm-hmm. And honestly, in our products, we're starting to very soon. We're going to have something. We have something that's been using a ChatGPT model, so that you could ask questions of our, about our product inside the product. It was trained on all of our help center documentation, so you can ask a plain language question and it's going to give you an answer. We're going to have some Gen AI models coming out soon, so it's going to be able to tell you things about your environment, and you're going to be able to tell it to do things back, as opposed to just answering questions. You're going to be able to give it commands. So there's a lot of different things. That's kind of like the front door to what the AI world is for so many people.
Right. Yeah. And I think one of the shortcomings of all of the models right now is you bake them and they're done.
Yeah.
You can supplement them with RAG. Was that retrieval augmented modeling or something like that? You can augment it with that, but essentially, once the model's done, it's baked and that's what it understands. Mm-hmm. And so within a certain context window, you can provide it additional information. But when you go back later, it's like a goldfish, right? It's already forgotten everything that you've told it. And you have to tell it that same stuff again, which is what prompt engineering is all about. It's about setting up that context window so it has the additional knowledge you want so you can ask the question properly.
Yeah.
And that, I think the next, maybe one of the next big steps is more dynamic learning on the model's side. I'm not sure how that would be accomplished. That's way above my pay grade.
Yeah.
But like the example of the strawberry issue.
I remember that. Yeah.
So for folks who are not familiar with this issue, and it's been since fixed in 4.0 of ChatGPT or not ChatGPT, of GPT 4.0. The problem was if you asked older models how many R's are in the word strawberry, it would tell you 2, which, I mean, for those playing at home, is clearly wrong.
Yeah. Write it out on a page and count them up just to be sure.
Yeah. You're not going crazy. It is absolutely wrong. But the reason it did that was because of the way that it split the word into tokens and then did its analysis. Is it would see, hey, there's an R in this token. There's an R in this token. That's 2. There's 2 R's. And then you could tell it, no, there's 3. And it would come back and say, no, I'm sorry, you're wrong. There's 2. And it didn't learn.
Yes.
So that's, I think
it was
that's
stubborn. It couldn't accept that it was wrong. It was, and face facts.
Right. And maybe through a prompt, you could get it for that session to tell you that there's 3, but it didn't resolve the underlying issue of how it was right. determining that.
The next person that asked the same question was going to get the wrong answer again. It didn't go, oh, you've helped me understand something better.
Right. And so the newer models that they've introduced try to do sort of step-by-step reasoning in the same way that you might chain models together or chain responses together to help one model help the other reason. Now they're kind of trying to do that internally. And that's definitely helping to a certain degree, but you're still getting this weird, inconsistent behavior at times. So being able to teach yeah. it would be useful.
I'm only laughing because I was playing with the generative AI in Photoshop the other day. I had this picture that I took before a meeting started, and it was supposed to be, you know, how everybody puts out on LinkedIn, look at all the people that were at my meeting today, blah, blah, blah. I'm like, how hard would it be to put a fake crowd in this? It created some horror story looking crowds.
Yeah.
It's like, fill all the chairs in this room with people. And these people looked like I don't want to think about it because it was very nightmarish, but I'm like, so we're not there yet. It's like, technically they were things in human form, but they sure weren't people. Or the pictures right. where you see, you know, the old joke is the six fingered, person looking for the mm-hmm. kind of stuff, or three legs under the table, things like that. When they're showing a picture, it yeah. just doesn't know all that nuance yet.
I think it's funny that you say the old joke, where that joke is 2 years old. Yeah. At the most at this point. I think people need to remember that while AI has a long and storied history, the current generation of AI, I'm going to use generation in two ways here, the current generation of AI that we're in is actually not that old at all.
Yeah.
I was trying to look it up real quick when the Google engineers wrote the paper that the current generative pre-trained transformer is based off of. I think it was 2000, somewhere in the 2010s,
yeah.
The paper was written. And then the first GPT model came out in 2018 through OpenAI. And it was not particularly, you know, that was, you know, GPT-1. It didn't
what
really get
of a 1.0 release, right? Yeah.
Didn't really get, well, it wasn't even publicly available until right. GPT-3, I believe. And that was quickly revved to 3.5 in, what was that, 2021 or something?
I think, yeah.
It is wild that this technology is only 3 years old and the amount of progress we've made. I've seen a few posts saying, you know, where's GPT-5? It's taking so long. Have we reached the upper limit of what's possible with GPT-based large language models and AI? And maybe we have. Maybe we've hit a roadblock. But that's the way that AI has always progressed, is just stepping up to a point where you hit a roadblock. And then there's some breakthrough either from a theory side, a software side, or a hardware side that breaks through and moves to the next phase. And we just had one of those major breakthroughs 3 years ago.
Yeah.
It might be a few years before we have another major breakthrough. And we have no idea where that's going to come from, if it's going to be a hardware-based breakthrough or something that's more about software and theory and the way that they're writing these models. There might be something new that's not GPT based that takes us to the next level of AI.
Yeah, anything's possible at this point. I mean, I just reading what I've read about it, just what the thinking process of even coming up with this. And remember that this stuff is not creating itself on its own. Because next topic I want to get into is, you know, we've talked about the greatness of it. I want to talk about the the FUD that's out there. Right. But it, you know, it's people need to learn how to teach these models to learn or come up with new models. So, I mean, you have to understand, and it takes the next generation. I mean, the amazing thing is when you look at the names of the people that are the, you know, the top of the field in AI, it's the same people who have been in the top of the field in AI since like the 70s. Like, it's the same folks,
right.
Maybe even the 60s. Like, as long as we've had, you know, better access to computers beyond, like, you know, having one down at the University of Pennsylvania that the whole country used, you know, it's been the same people that have been the leaders in it. So it's going to take the next generation learning from this and expanding. And the beautiful thing is all those people are out there teaching.
Right.
You know, they're almost all in some sort of, not necessarily at a university education, but they're in places like Google or, you know, even Meta. And they're doing a lot of great work to teach the next generation how to do these things. So heaven knows where it's going to come from.
Yeah. And like you said, so far I've sounded a little bit too rah-rah, I love AI. And I don't want people to get the wrong impression that I'm like an AI boomer, because I'm not. But I'm also not.
Ned's not real. He's an AI. I'm just talking to a chatbot.
But I'm not an AI doomer either. Yeah. I don't believe that ChatGPT is going to take over the world and cause the destruction of all of humanity. It seems fairly unlikely. But I also don't think it's the greatest thing since sliced bread. I mean, sliced bread is pretty amazing if you've ever tried to slice a whole loaf yourself. Yeah. as someone who makes sourdough bread on a regular basis, actually slicing a loaf well is a difficult thing.
Very challenging. Now imagine a nice soft loaf of like your multigrain wheat that you get at the store and trying to slice that.
Forget about it. That's why they have the machine at the store.
Exactly. It was a game changer. That's why we still use it as the example, what, almost 100 years later, probably?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. So, yeah, I mean, there's obviously all kinds of issues with AI and the way it's being applied today. Part of that was just the absolute gold rush that happened a couple of years ago, and everybody slapping AI on their stuff and AI washing. I was hearing it called a lot. I think that's died down a little bit. The obvious scams have mostly died down, and now it's getting down to people are more conscious of people are just more conscious of the fact that it could be fake.
Yeah.
Of that the AI label that, you know, vendors, whoever put on their stuff, that could be misleading. And so they're approaching with a little more caution and skepticism, which is good.
So that's a good point. They think when you talk about realizing things aren't real, we didn't all see it, but a lot of us saw Rogue One, the Star Wars movie, where at the end they had Princess Leia.
Oh, yeah.
It was not good. It's gotten better. I was watching a TV show with my wife last night. It's on Netflix that Ted Danson's in. Obviously, Ted Danson is, you know, I don't know what age he is, but he's white hair, older.
Yeah.
And whatever it was, they were showing an old home movie and they de-aged him.
Mm.
And it was if you didn't know who Ted Danson was and didn't watch Cheers and Three Men and a Baby and all that stuff, you're like, it's not bad, but you're like, oh, this is just so off. And it's just so strange to watch. So there's things like that. The things that are scary are some of these voice generated systems where you can, you know, that was a big scam for a while. I haven't heard as much about it lately, where people were calling, you know, they get a voice sample of a relative. Mm-hmm. And scam the people using the relative and just having them say whatever they needed to say to get them to open their bank account, send the money, whatever.
It is still absolutely happening. I read an article last week that was an interesting punch back at that. Some folks over in the UK wrote an AI old lady. Mm. And basically she would keep scammers on the phone for as long as possible by just pretending to be confused and uncertain, but willing to help, but a little bit, you know, but not too willing to help. And I was listening to some of the audio of it, and she would keep scammers on the phone for 45 an hour.
That's so great.
And so there is the possibility of using it for both ill and good.
I love that though, because maybe, you know, if their cost per call keeps going up, maybe they'll stop doing it.
Unfortunately, AI is kind of expensive, so I don't know how much it costs to run that model.
That's a good point. Yeah. Very good point. Yes. Yeah. So, I mean, a lot of people are worried, AI is going to come and take my job. We were talking about like the dictating for Dragon, naturally speaking, at the beginning of the conversation. And I'm willing to bet that your dad's assistant did not lose her job because she didn't have to type in off of dictaphone tapes anymore.
No, far from it. And I think that was actually a major improvement.
Yeah.
Not having to sit there and type that out.
Yes.
No, he continued while he was at that law firm. She continued to be his secretary for the remainder of the time he was there, which was another 10 or 12 years before he moved on to something else. And she just learned new skills, and that's kind of what everybody has to do.
Yeah.
Now, I mean, fortunately, the law firm was supportive of teaching people new skills rather than just going, well, you're a dinosaur now and we're going to hire someone brand new. You know, they recognized that she brought a lot more value than just being able to transcribe my dad's ramblings. She was, and yeah, so I think that's probably on the employers out there to be willing to, as certain skills become less useful because AI is replacing it, mm-hmm. recognizing that your people still have value and are more than just the operations that they've been doing so far.
Yeah.
How can you take those same people and use them to further improve what you do as a company? You already have these human resources. Don't love that term, but you already have these folks in your organization that have proven themselves capable. How can you reapply them to further what your company is trying to do? It's wild to me that companies are like, well, we spent all this money training you and getting you integrated into our systems and learning our culture and being part of, you know, this workplace. And we're just going to let you go. Like, yeah, you are throwing away
counterproductive.
So much.
Yes.
By doing that, compared to the amount that it would cost you to skill this person up a little bit in another area.
Yeah. Because they've already proven that they're valuable because they've already, you know, I'm sure that she had been with the company for years already.
Yeah.
And there's stories of that all over the place. You know, taking one skill and automating it isn't enough to do away with that. Now, you know, there are things change though. I remember at my first job, there was I think it was called the word processing department. Mm. Now everybody in the company had a computer on their desk, but these folks were dynamos at typing, formatting documents, inserting images and examples wherever they needed to for these official documents. I'm willing to bet a lot of companies don't have those people in that role anymore. But again, if somebody can type quickly, if somebody knows how to format a doc, just because I can go in and I get tons of suggestions on the sidebar of Word of how I should format things, or even PowerPoint, I have to laugh every time I try to alter a PowerPoint slide. It gives me 20 suggestions, none of which I can use because they're not in the corporate, you know, template model.
Right.
So it doesn't know anything about that. You still know it doesn't really learn what is the style that you need. It'll make suggestions. There's still, like you said, there's way, and I think this is true. I think it's just that right now it's one of the things that people are scared of because it's hitting white collar areas. Like, we're used to hearing blue collar jobs having to retrain, you know, robots in auto manufacturing or, mm-hmm. you know, automation of that sort and reteaching and retraining. But I think this is one of the first big ways that people see it as possibly altering white collar jobs.
Yeah. And, you know, for people who thought that, you know, I got this great white collar job, I'm safe. Yeah. I can just like kind of cruise things out for the next 20 years as long as I'm, you know, stamping the right forms.
Still being productive. Yeah.
Still being moderately productive. I'm good. And yeah, it's a little scary to think, no, I actually have to continue to put work in.
Well, I look at it this way, and it's, you know, somebody, if I was still doing what I did when I started in this, you know, career, this job market 30 years ago, I wouldn't have a job anyway, if I never retaught myself or anything. I mean, one of my biggest mottos always, when somebody says, what words do you have for people? It's always be learning.
Always.
Because, you know, putting Sims into a Macintosh computer, a Mac 2 series is not, it's not something I'm going to make a lot of money on, you know, knowing, you know, DOS 6.3 or whatever is not going to get me a lot very far these days. Things like that, you know, it's like you always have to be redefining yourself. So don't be scared of these things. If it takes one skill away from you, take that as an opportunity to learn another skill. And I think that takes away some of the doom and gloom.
Yeah. I'm happy that I'm no longer troubleshooting issues with parallel ports on registers yes. at stores, which was something I did for a while, was like troubleshooting register issues for a retailer. I'm happy I'm not doing that anymore. But I think one of the implied things when you get into technology, at least, is that you are going to have to learn constantly. Mm-hmm. So I think for those of us who are in technology, that's taken as a given. That's an assumption, because we know that things change. We know that new technology is introduced on a regular cadence, and you're always going to have to learn something new. And that's just baked into our philosophy. But I feel as though other jobs don't have that ethos baked into them. And so that's something that you might be surprised by if you, you know, went in thinking, you know, I don't, I'm trying to think of a job that doesn't change a ton. I guess all of them do. Maybe, you know, you help drive a trash truck and, you know, you throw trash in the back and you compact it, and that's not going to change, right? Like that's,
but it did.
But it did.
You have that magic arm that comes out and lifts the thing, so there's not two guys hanging off the back of the truck.
Right.
So even that changed. Everything changed. Automation. There's everything one guy in my trash changing. Truck that comes around. Yeah.
Yeah. So I guess like that really speaks to the example is you may have, you know, gotten that job 30 years ago.
Yeah.
And for the first 25 years, it did not change significantly. Mm-hmm. And then this technology evolution comes along and suddenly you only need one person driving the truck and nobody on the back. Well, that is a huge shift for the people that were working that job. I hope that the company that ran the service found a way to retrain those folks or maybe expand their reach or do something else.
Yeah. Maybe they got some more trucks and everybody's a driver now and they, you know, get to stay out of the weather for their, you know, for their sake.
Yeah.
You never know.
I hope that one of the things that kids are learning as they come up through school and through college is that learning process doesn't stop when you get the degree.
Yeah.
And it will not stop for any given job that you pick. If you want to do something for the next 30 years and have it never change, that's a hobby.
Yeah.
Like go find a hobby and do that
even
hobby.
Even that changes. You know, it used to be you could buy a camera. I'm a photographer. You could buy a camera and that same, you know, the camera I had in high school would have been just fine forever if digital never showed up. Now it's like every 5 years, your camera body's obsolete. The lenses are still good, but the camera, even those change because they have so much image state. There's technology in those. There's technology in everything anymore. So there's a chance for everything to change. I know my son is in the accounting field and he's a little worried about this stuff, but at the same rate, you know, a big part of his job is also dealing with people.
Right.
He does audit and things like that. So he's meeting with clients, but he's worried that some of this stuff could be changed to take some of his, you know, the knowledge that he's taken the time to learn and continuing to learn and turn it into a couple buttons. Now, to be fair, that's been happening all along because before Excel, you were writing in general ledgers and using the big old adding machines where you tick, 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 brr, tick, 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 brr. He's not doing that anymore. He's putting formulas into Excel. Yeah, those formulas are probably gonna be easier. Or now there's software that you just put in some raw numbers and it spits out everything you need, including the document on the other side. That's not job replacement. That's efficiency.
Right.
But again, keep learning. There's always more stuff you can learn. Just keep being useful.
Yeah, I guess that's, if there's one takeaway about this whole AI revolution and everything that's happening is if you are a human that is curious and willing to learn and better yourself, there's going to be a spot for you in the future.
Mm-hmm.
And part of that responsibility lies on you, the person, being curious and being willing to learn. And part of that, I think, can be pushed back on employers that they also have to offer the opportunities to their employees to do that learning. So there's a bit of a dual responsibility there. You have to have the gumption and want to learn, but you also have to have the opportunity to learn, especially at work.
Yes.
And that doesn't always happen. So yeah, if I have one thing to say to the rank and file, the employees is like, be curious, learn things. My title at Ned in the Cloud is Curious Human.
That's an excellent, because I think that's the best kind of human. You know, I don't want somebody that doesn't question what's going on around them. I'm not saying be conspiracy theorist kind of guy, but why does that work? How does that work? What's the next thing come? That's a great way to be. Like I said, my motto is always be learning. Goes right in with being curious human.
Yeah. And if you are a boss or someone who manages other people, now's the time to start advocating for them to learn if you don't have a learning program in place, because AI is coming for a lot of those job functions, or at least portions of them. And you want to get ahead of that and have your people ready to skill up to the next thing and keep them relevant and productive in your organization.
I think you're absolutely right. And I think AI, I think the future is bright for it. And I think that it is bright for it as long as the people, because remember, the people are still in charge. This is not Skynet. This is not the Matrix. It is still the people are in control. I don't see us getting to that point, but we have the opportunity here to use an amazing new tool. We're not still out there with our donkey and a plow pushing through the fields. You know, let's look at the technology. Everything changes, but there's still need people. People aren't going anywhere. Mm-hmm. So cheer up there, AI doomists and alarmists. We're okay. We're going to be okay. So before we wrap up, tell me a little bit about some of the projects you have going on. You've got a podcast and you have some other things that people definitely should check out.
Oh, I always have too many projects and got too many plates spinning up in the air. But the podcast that I want to mention specifically, if people are interested in getting more of the context and history of technology, is called Chaos Lever. And me and my buddy Chris do episodes on Chaos Lever, and our goal is to put the context in technology.
Okay.
So look at what's happening, but then also look at where did it come from? The most recent episode that we did was about telephone systems and how they evolved over time from human operators sitting in central offices connecting your call to these modern, fully automated systems and what happened in the interim. And we have a guest on that one, Sarah Autumn from the Connections Museum in Seattle. And she is just a wealth of information around all things telephony. So I think if you're going to start with an episode, that's probably a banger to start with.
Fun, because I was actually going to bring that up as an example of jobs that have changed, where you used to have rooms full of people connecting wires. Mm-hmm. As that was your switch. Now, then you went into you know, the 70s and 80s is where it really changed and became automated. And now it's, you know, it's flash fast.
Yeah. The very first automated switches came out in the 1940s, I believe.
No kidding. And, that old. I didn't realize that.
Or 1930s. It was around that time. They were still fully mechanical. So just electromechanical machines.
Okay.
And with no reasoning or transistors in there or anything like that. Switches. It was literally when you were dialing the number with your rotary dial phone, that would physically be moving a rod in the switching system to connect your call to the number.
Wow.
And if you watch some of the YouTube videos that the Connections Museum has up, she'll walk you through that entire process of how that worked.
I'm going to check out that episode for
sure. It is awesome. And I'm so glad that she came on and talked to us about it.
But yeah, where can we get that? Where do you have that available for?
Just chaoslever.com is the webpage. Or if you just search Chaos Lever in your podcast catcher of choice.
Cool.
You should find it there.
Awesome. That sounds so cool. And I'll definitely be checking it out. This has been an awesome conversation. This is something I think it's fascinating. I think we could, you know, talk forever about it. And I hope that we've inspired some people to talk about it themselves and, you know, really start to think about their opinions and form some opinions. We didn't really talk about things as far as how it relates to, you know, Veeam partners per se today, but I think it's something that pertains to everybody and you should really be thinking about how this technology is going to change everything we do. So I really appreciate having you on. This was a lot of fun. It was great to be able to catch up with you again.
Well, Eric, thank you for the opportunity. And if anybody wants to reach out to me, you can find me at nedinthecloud.com or just ping me on LinkedIn. My messages are open.
I appreciate it. Thanks again.
This has been Veeam Partner Perspectives with Eric Dougherty. Thank you for listening.